Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Wednesday, December 6, 2023. Women's rights activists in South Sudan say cultural norms encourage the mistreatment of women and girls.
Right now, whatever I have is taken by force from me. Every time he demands money from me, whenever I refuse his demands, he starts beating me with a big lock.
And South Sudanese nationals are reportedly fighting on both sides of Sudan's ongoing conflict.
A lot of South Sudanese are also involved and engaging in the war in Sudan on both sides as mercenaries. This has been actually officially reported.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Gender-based violence survivors and women rights activists say several forms of gender-based violence, including physical assault and forced marriages, remain a huge challenge for women in many Jonglei State communities. One woman says she was subjected to frequent beatings and denied food after she refused to marry a relative of her late husband. Manyang David Mayar reports for VOA from Juba.
Widow Kwan Garang says her life changed for the worse after her husband was killed when fighting between government forces and those loyal to Vice President Riek Machar spread from the capital Juba to Bor in December 2013. She says her deceased husband's relatives forced her to marry one of their kinsmen, a practice she says is common in the Dinka community. Garang says she refused to be inherited, adding that her late husband's relatives subjected her to constant beating, verbal abuse, and even deprived her of food.
Right now, whatever I have is taken by force from me. Every time he demands money from me, whenever I refuse his demands, he starts beating me with a big lock. He constantly says I will kill you and nobody will ask me. When I think about the way he treats me, I wonder why, and it makes me think a lot.
Garang says when her late husband died, he left some property, including cattle, but her late husband's relatives confiscated her cattle and other possessions.
But now with my husband's relatives here, he does not allow me to know whatever belongs to me. He uses his power to intimidate me as I am a weak person. So he does not allow me to know anything, even things that are my rights.
Teddy Shandia, a gender-based violence project officer with the international charity group Interchurch Medical Assistance, says cultural norms in the area encourage the abuse of women.
The culture in this community has taken it as it was not a violence to them. It was a normal thing, like for a man to discipline a wife. It is not something big to them at first. But now, men have also got the consequences of all that they are doing.
Chandia says Interchurch Medical Assistance is helping to create awareness about the dangers of gender-based violence, or GBV, and to encourage victims to report abuse.
GBV cases reporting in 2019, it was actually not there because people were fearing too much to report. They are so attached to the culture, and because of that cultural fear, they are not easily coming. So we started with a lot of awareness with my team, because if you don't report this, some of these violence are so bad, like if rape cases is not reported within 72 hours, then other harmful things can happen in the life of the survivor.
Shandia says physical assault, psychological abuse, denial of resources, and sexual violence are common in Jonglei. She says a one-stop center in Bor State Hospital offers gender-based violence survivors psychosocial, medical, and legal support in the state capital, Bor. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
South Sudan's interior minister says she has been informed that South Sudanese are fighting on both sides of Sudan's ongoing conflict. Angelina Teng says the participation of South Sudanese nationals in the war could have serious security implications for the country. A political analyst says the involvement of South Sudanese complicates South Sudan's position as a neutral country that wants to mediate between Sudan's warring parties. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
At a recent forum in Juba, Interior Minister Angelina Teng said a strange development was taking place in the conflict in Sudan.
A lot of South Sudanese are also involved and engaging in the war in Sudan on both sides as mercenaries. This has been actually officially reported.
Teng said the government thinks the involvement of South Sudanese in the conflict will have negative implications for South Sudan's security in the long run.
We're very concerned that, you know, they're getting access to these arms. You never know where these arms are going to end up or what they could be used for. So it's a concern for us. We have not yet had evidence of arms crossing into South Sudan, but the likelihood of it happening is very real.
The Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been fighting across the country since April. Thousands have been killed in the fighting. The United Nations has estimated about 5 million people have been displaced by the war, with nearly 1 million of them fleeing to other countries. Abraham Kuol Nyon is a professor of political science at the University of Juba. He says the involvement of South Sudanese in the Sudan conflict makes it difficult for President Salva Kiir's government to convince the warring parties that South Sudan is neutral.
Remember some few months ago, When this conflict of Sudan began, South Sudan was proposed to be one of the mediators, especially President Kiir. And the involvement of South Sudanese in the conflict will complicate the impartiality of the South Sudan to act as a mediator. And as a result of this, I strongly believe if there is going to be a group that is going to win over other group, and that group knows that they might have win because of the negligence of the people of South Sudan having no support, that will have a security implication because they will not be able to go down well with the people of South Sudan.
Professor Nguyen says, having confirmed that there are South Sudanese citizens involved on both sides of the conflict, the Juba government should have distanced itself from their activities to maintain its cordial relations with Sudan.
It is only if the government of South Sudan declare their position very openly, that whatever which is happening in Sudan and whoever is involved in the war of Sudan is not on behalf of the government of South Sudan. And that is the only way now the neutrality of the government of South Sudan will not be in question. And as a result of this, this is the only option the government has so far to be able to show not only to the people of Sudan, but to the international community that in fact they are neutral and impartial.
Information about South Sudanese participating in the conflict surfaced about 3 weeks ago when pictures of some of the South Sudanese fighters were posted on social media. Some regional observers and security experts say Sudan's warring parties are recruiting foreign nationals to strengthen their fighting capacities. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Growing evidence indicates that women and girls are disproportionately impacted by climate change, particularly in the global south, according to a recent report by UN Women. The report emphasizes that women have limited access to economic resources, and it hinders their ability to adapt to changing weather patterns, disrupting infrastructure and public services. Laura Turkey, a policy advisor at UN Women, stresses the necessity of a feminist approach to climate change, centering the knowledge and experiences of women and girls. As the UN Climate Change Conference unfolds in Dubai, she discusses these crucial perspectives with me from New York.
We launched a new report called Feminist Climate Justice, a Framework for Action on Gender Day at COP28, which is the the big global climate negotiations that happen are taking place right now in Dubai. The reason that we're launching this approach is because there's growing evidence of the linkages between climate change and gender inequality. So I think over the past decades, we've seen, you know, slow, incremental, somewhat fragile progress on gender equality. But now, because of climate change, we're seeing a reversal of that progress and real threats to gender equality and women's rights. And that's because in the context of extreme weather, you know, floods, droughts and so on, women, particularly in the global south, tend to be much poorer than men. They have less access to resources like jobs and land. And so when extreme weather hits, they're much less able to rebuild and recover. So we're really concerned about that. And so we're calling on governments to make sure that they put gender equality issues at the heart of all of their climate action, their climate financing, and their climate policies.
And in your op-ed, you emphasize the importance of recognizing, redistributing, representing, and repairing to achieve feminist climate justice. Can you provide specific examples of initiatives that align with each of these pillars or any?
Sure. Yeah. So feminist climate justice, we identify four key dimensions, which, you know, provide governments with some guidance on how they can achieve feminist climate justice. And the first one is about recognition. So that's really about recognizing women's rights, their knowledge and their labor. And I think the specific example I would give here is the importance of recognizing the knowledge that women at a local level, indigenous women, rural women, the knowledge that they have of their local context and their lives and their livelihoods. Because sometimes when we see, you know, adaptation policies, policies that are designed to help communities to adapt to climate impacts, they don't always take into account local knowledge. And sometimes that actually leads to projects that do more harm than good. On redistribution, as I mentioned before, women tend to be poorer than men. And so redistribution is really about ensuring that as we move to low emission economies, we're going to have to change our economies. And as we move to low emission economies, it's a real opportunity to make sure that women are at the front of the queue for those new green jobs in those new green sectors. And that is a way of addressing the inequalities that women have faced in terms of access to jobs and wage gaps and so on. And then representation is about ensuring that we have women's voices represented in climate decision making, from the local level in things like, you know, forestry committees at local level, up to national level, ensuring that we have women well represented in parliaments and as ministers in environment ministries, and then ensuring that we have women represented in COP delegations, so that they're, you know, at the table when the climate negotiations are happening. And the reason we call for that is because we know that when women are involved in decision making, those decisions are more likely to reflect the reality of women's lives and a diversity of approaches. So the final one is about reparations, and that's really about recognizing that the global north is responsible for the vast majority of historical carbon emissions. And it's women in the global south who've done least to cause the problems that are bearing the brunt of the climate crisis. And so in acknowledging that, we also want to make sure that there's, you know, generous climate finance that's going to where it's needed, to the women and the girls who are at the forefront of the climate crisis. And one of the things that's being negotiated at COP this year is the Loss and Damage Fund. And so it will be really important as member states kind of think about that fund to make sure that women and girls are prioritized for receiving that finance.
And accountability is highlighted as a crucial aspect of the feminist climate justice approach. How can governments and global leaders enhance accountability, particularly in the context of addressing the urgent demands for bold climate action?
Yeah, so this is a real challenge. I think we've seen, you know, women's movements and other social movements demanding action on climate change for a long time now. And there's a real mismatch between those demands and how fast governments are moving. And we know that the climate crisis is really urgent at this point. I mean, the latest UN estimates are that without, you know, a radical change of course, we're heading for 3 degrees of global heating by the end of the century. And that means an increasingly unlivable planet. So we do need much greater accountability for climate action. And I think, women's organizations, social movements, environmental activists have been really kind of on the forefront of this issue in their local communities demanding change. But quite often we see that those activists, they're not rewarded for their activism. They're actually often harassed and, arrested and sometimes even killed. And so we need to see, an end to that kind of violence and an end to that kind of impunity and safe spaces created for that kind of activism.
That's Laura Turkey, a policy advisor at UN Women. She spoke with me from New York yesterday. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, we look at visa restrictions on individuals undermining democracy in Zimbabwe. Stay tuned.
Around the world, people are marking the United Nations 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Help us mark the work to end violence against women by sharing your thoughts on VOA's English to Africa radio programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076 before December 10th. Tell us what is being done in your community to fight gender-based violence and tell us why this issue is important to you. That number again is +1 202 258 3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party is reacting angrily to a new visa restriction policy which U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced this week, aimed at people accused of undermining democracy in the southern African nation. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where the opposition is berating the United States for the latest move.
Lauren Socha, spokesperson at the U.S. Embassy in Harare, told VOA that the new visa restriction policy would affect individuals believed to be responsible for or complicity in undermining democracy. He said that they include manipulating or rigging the electoral process, de-enfranchising voters, restricting the work of civil society organizations, or intimidating voters.
Such acts might also include engaging in corruption, including bribery that undermines the electoral process, interfering with the independent operation of the judiciary, or abusing or violating human rights in Zimbabwe. The visa restriction policy will apply to specific individuals involved in these acts, and it is not directed at the Zimbabwean people. The United States supports Zimbabweans' aspirations to have free and fair elections that reflect the will of the people and strengthen democracy, the rule of law, and the protection of human rights.
Zimbabwe's August general election was marred by delays and shortages of materials in opposition strongholds. Many observer missions, including from the Southern African Development Community, said the process fell far short of requirements of the country's electoral laws, as well as the regional bloc's guidelines. Jonathan Moyo, a former government minister in Zimbabwe, says the new restrictions are meant to make citizens revolt against their government after the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act of 2001, known as ZEDERA, failed to do so. Then U.S. President George W. Bush signed into law the measure aimed at promoting economic growth and the rule of law.
An objective empirical assessment of this latest measure is really an admission, first and foremost, that ZEDERA has failed, that the Americans have become hopeless, the Americans, meaning the American government, have become jittery, and they now are resorting to legal instruments that were there in 2001. But now they think they can achieve what they've failed to achieve through ZEDERA.
Farai Mwaiwa Marapira, a ZANU-PF spokesman, voiced agreement with Mwoyo.
As ZANU-PF, we are not surprised by this new activity by the American government. We all know that their intent on changing the government and all their machinations having failed in August some tantrums they expected, and this is what is obtaining. We remain unfazed and we remain resolute. We hold on to the words of wisdom from our president, President Edim Nangagwa. We are an enemy to none and a friend to all, and our doors are open.
Moyo says he doubts the new U.S. visa restrictions will have an impact. However, Promise Mkwananzi, the spokesman for the country's main opposition party, the Citizens Coalition for Change, is more hopeful.
We note the measures taken by the Americans against the authors and sponsors of chaos, illegitimacy and illegality in Zimbabwe. I think it is important not just for the American government, but as well as other governments, regional bodies such as SADC and others, to ensure that they put some disincentive against people who would want to undermine the will of the people of Zimbabwe and disrespect the voice of the Zimbabwean people, including, of course, those that are not in ZANU-PF, who are in complicit with the regime in undermining the wishes and the will of the people of Zimbabwe.
The opposition says it is hopeful that regional body SADC will call for fresh polls following the chaos which characterized Zimbabwe's August elections. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare.
As a debate over loans and trade relations with China heats up in Nairobi, the Chinese embassy in Nairobi is looking to boost cultural ties with Kenyans by launching food extravaganzas. Victoria Amunga has more from Nairobi.
At a hotel in Nairobi, Kenya's capital, dozens of people gather to watch this display of Chinese culture. This performance ushers in a food festival sponsored by the Chinese embassy and hosted by Kenya's China Teachers Association. President of SYNC International Education, Michelle Chang, says their goal is to promote Chinese culture and keep the relationship between Kenya and China strong.
This year, 2023, is the 60th anniversary of Kenya and China diplomatic relationships set up. So I think we should keep in touch more and more and closer and to become like good diplomatic relations within both countries.
Forging stronger ties through cultural events can also bridge language differences, says economist Eric Musau.
European countries generally have always had very strong ties, looking at the Commonwealth or America. The common language is always a big positive between Kenya and most of Europe as well as America. So for the Chinese, there's that gap, especially around the language barrier. They've been trying to encourage more Kenyans to study the language.
Chinese presence in Kenya has been growing over the years. Chinese companies have built massive projects in Kenya, like the Standard Gauge Railway between Nairobi and Mombasa. At the same time, Kenya's central bank says the trade deficit between Nairobi and Beijing grew to $3.62 billion US dollars in 2022, up from $3.51 billion US dollars the previous year. Musau says the infrastructure is beneficial for Kenya, but the trade disparity is a challenge for diplomatic relations.
In terms of exports to their market, you're looking at just a couple of $100 million. So the balance of trade is really in their favor. And when you look at the structure of the economies and where, for example, Kenya wants to go, it's very unlikely that you'll ever have a very good overlap in terms of a balance of trade compared to, let's say, America, where exports and imports are almost on balance.
Balance is something that Steve Wakoli says he was missing in his life before he learned the Chinese language and martial arts like Kung Fu. He now makes his living teaching Chinese and performing martial arts.
I started receiving invitations from companies for performances. I went to schools like Chinese Confucius schools. I went to Kenyatta University, went to Nairobi universities for performance.
But Wakoli is an exception. Many Kenyans are uneasy by what they say is too much Chinese engagement in Kenya, especially in the retail sector. Trader Lucy Wanjiku explains.
Come over here.
She says, we used to buy clothing from China, but now they have their own store here, and what they sell is cheap. Our customers all go to their store to find cheap products. Because of the infrastructure projects, Kenya's debt to China stood at $6.3 billion as of March 2023, almost two-thirds of the country's total bilateral external debt. Analysts say cultural programs such as this food festival aims to ease uncertainty caused by what some Kenyans see as unbalanced economic relationship. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai has made an impassioned plea for what she calls gender apartheid to be made a crime under international law. Speaking at an event in South Africa, Yousafzai called on the world to pay attention to what's happening to girls and women under Taliban rule in Afghanistan. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani activist who survived being shot in the head when she was 15 years old by Taliban gunmen for daring to pursue an education, delivered the annual Nelson Mandela Foundation lecture in South Africa Tuesday, which this year marked a decade since the death of South Africa's first democratically elected president. The 26-year-old drew parallels between Mandela's long struggle against white minority rule and racial segregation under the apartheid regime in South Africa and the situation facing women in Afghanistan in the 2 years since the Taliban returned to power.
With Mandela's legacy in mind, I asked myself, what injustice is the world overlooking? Where are we allowing inhumanity become the status quo? The answer for me was very clear and very personal. The oppression of girls and women in Afghanistan.
Yousafzai, who won the Nobel Peace Prize aged just 17, decried the fact that other crises have drawn the world's attention away from the situation in Afghanistan, where girls are not allowed to attend secondary school and women are banned from working or even leaving the house on their own.
South Africans fought for racial apartheid to be recognized and criminalized at the international level, but gender apartheid has not been explicitly codified yet. That is why I call on every government in every country to make gender apartheid a crime against humanity.
Mandela's widow and women's rights advocate, Grasa Michelle, also spoke at the event.
Let's be very precise. This thing of men thinking that they have a right over the lives of women, this thing of them believing that they have a right over the bodies of women,
Yousafzai said the United Nations should adopt language on gender apartheid in a new Crimes Against Humanity treaty it is drafting. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's all we have for you this Wednesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite program and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Dunobi by Kwambena Kwambena.
Shemani mau matia mami shewi, so bi da adoni bi. Yazi ma yewe adakoni ado, oh yeah. Yeti so mi mu ye, na wadati sa shesha. Shemani mami shewi.
Listening to Dunobi by Kwambena Kwambena. I'm your host, Nabil Biagio, in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Okoro, and engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Madame.